From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And right now we go to Washington, where House impeachment managers are formally presenting articles of impeachment to the Senate today, after which Chief Justice John Roberts will swear in all 100 senators to act as jurors in the trial, which is expected to begin next Tuesday. But even as the impeachment trial approaches, there's a decision out today from a government watchdog agency that the White House broke the law in freezing aid to Ukraine last year. President Trump's decision to freeze that aid, as we know, is at the center of the impeachment proceedings. NPR political reporter Tim Mak joins us now. And Tim, let's start with the impeachment procedures. There's been a lot of pomp and ceremony, but we've also heard from senators speaking today on the floor ahead of the vote of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which has passed. How have they weighed in on the impeachment so far?
Well, it's been pretty testy. And one observation I would make is that it's pretty evident that the Senate is in a kind of lockdown mode. You know, there's a much higher police presence in the Capitol than usual ahead of these impeachment proceedings. And that's led to a much more limited access by the press to senators and asking them what their feelings are, what their views are as this impeachment trial starts. So one of the major ways that congressional reporters like myself do our work is to walk and talk with senators as they come to and from votes. And that access has been limited. So one of the big takeaways for me this morning and this afternoon is kind of how we have had a much more restricted ability to talk and ask senators to weigh in on impeachment and to get their unfiltered views on how this is all coming along.
Okay. As I mentioned, Chief Justice John Roberts will swear in senators as jurors today. The oath he reads asks senators to, quote, do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. Many Republicans and Democrats have already said which way they'd vote on impeachment. I mean, that seems to directly be in conflict with this oath.
Right. Well, senators are technically not even allowed to speak during the trial itself, right? So as jurors, they are asked to sit in the Senate chamber without asking verbal questions or making any comments. And of course, as you may know, that's very unusual for senators. But they can speak to the press outside the chamber. And as you mentioned, some have done so. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, for example, has said that he's working closely with the White House and defense counsel in this trial. And Democrats have seized on this to say that this is an unfair trial already taking shape. McConnell has said, though, in response that the impeachment process as outlined in the Constitution and as it takes place has always kind of been a political process with political players, that lawmakers, elected officials are the ones that that impeach and the ones that are asked whether or not to convict.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to this report that just came out, this decision. The Government Accountability Office, which is a nonpartisan group that reports to Congress, released a decision this morning determining that the White House broke the law in withholding aid to Ukraine. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her press conference this morning.
The OMB, the White House, the administration broke, I'm saying this, broke the law. This reinforces, again, the need for documents and eyewitnesses in the Senate.
Could this report put pressure on Mitch McConnell to allow witnesses in this trial?
Right. Well, so this is a legal brief by this nonpartisan group that kind of does reports for Congress and for congressional oversight. And so Democrats are certainly hoping that this report will put pressure on Republicans who have been on the fence on the issue of witnesses. There are a number of Republican senators who have said that they might be open to it after opening arguments in this trial, perhaps in 2 weeks or so, that they might be open to witnesses. And this is just the latest kind of argument that Democrats are employing, that there is this report saying that this issue at the core of the impeachment process, whether or not the president could pause this aid or withhold this aid, this is just new evidence for Democrats to use to increase that pressure.
So much to watch for today and the weeks to come. Thank you so much. That's NPR political reporter Tim Mak.
Thank you.
Well, today, White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham downplayed explosive new interviews from Rudy Giuliani's associate Lev Parnas, in which Parnas said he was part of a campaign to pressure Ukraine to investigate the Bidens and that it was laughable to think it had anything to do with corruption. Grisham told The Washington Post she wasn't too concerned and that the president has said he did not know Parnas. But there are photos of them together and pictures of Donald Trump with Robert Hyde, the Republican candidate for Congress. Parnas Dennis has documents he says show Hyde discussing the physical location of the ambassador to Ukraine. Ukraine has opened an investigation into whether she was being surveilled. And Parnas told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow Trump knew about the Ukrainian pressure campaign.
What do you think is the main inaccuracy or the main lie that's being told that you feel like you can correct?
That the president didn't know what was going on. President Trump knew exactly what was going on. He was aware of all of my movements. I wouldn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani or the president.
Parnas was indicted in October on campaign finance charges. The president's supporters say that means he isn't trustworthy. Let's bring in Paul Soni, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Paul, you know, these interviews are pretty damning. Parnas, as we said, saying Trump knew what he was doing. But he never said, Trump told me to do this. So what was his proof?
Yeah, so I think in a way, what is more important are the contemporaneous text messages that have come out that Lev Parnas turned over to the House and that the House released a portion of than necessarily his statements and recollections. I think, you know, it's important to see, you know, he's saying that the president knew, that Rudy Giuliani knew. I think it's important to then look at other possible corroboration of that, whether it's contemporaneous text messages that he was sending, that Rudy Giuliani was sending, that referenced the president or that show that Rudy was involved all along, or, for example, you know, witness testimony under oath. And I think part of the release of this will increase that pressure to have more sort of evidence and witness testimony in the Senate trial.
Well, this, you're saying, as some are, that this kind of puts a bow on a lot of things that we've already heard. But can you give an example of a text that's been released?
Yeah. So a lot of what's been released is Lev Parnas was essentially serving as Rudy Giuliani's envoy in Ukraine. He was the person who was interacting in Russian with all of the Ukrainian officials and sort of where the rubber hit the road of what Rudy Giuliani wanted to accomplish in Ukraine. So you see, for example, a text message from the attorney general, the equivalent of the attorney general of Ukraine. They call it the prosecutor general, where he's saying, hey, you know, my statements about Biden are contingent upon you getting this ambassador who I hate fired. And so that's sort of there in bald language for everyone to see and understand. There are also a lot of instances in the text messages where it's very clear that Rudy Giuliani is dialed into what is going on. And there are references to what Rudy Giuliani calls number one or a lawyer he was working with call the big one, suggesting that they were meeting with Trump and talking to Trump about this all along.
And do I remember that some of the text messages from the Ukrainians who were being asked to participate in this said things like, I will get you the dirt on your competitor. You know, in other words, they characterize Biden as a competitor.
Yeah. So Yuri Lutsenko, who is the was the prosecutor general of Ukraine, texts Lev Parnas, and he's angry that the request that he has given, he's requested, I think, some meetings in Washington. He's requesting that the ambassador be removed. And he's angry that he's already begun providing helpful public statements about Biden to them, and they are not holding up their end of the bargain. And he sends a text message to Lev Parnas saying, you know, hey, I'm prepared to thrash your competitor and you're asking more and more and more of me. You know, we're over. I don't want to deal with you anymore. This is all just a joke. I'm sick of it. And so I think that kind of fidelity about what was going on in real time last year as Giuliani sought to accomplish his goals and sought to help bolster Trump in the 2020 campaign using information from Ukraine, we just have a lot more now sort of technicolor understanding of that from these text messages.
Well, he also spreads the net a little wider. Parnas says Attorney General William Barr was in on it. The Justice Department has denied that. That Vice President Mike Pence knew. That Devin Nunes, you know, who famously rolled his eyes in the House inquiry as if to say, oh, this is such a nothing burner, that he knew. What was the proof of all of this wider net?
Yeah, so there's nothing that I have seen in the documents and the contemporaneous text messages and notes that Lev Parnas took over to suggest a knowledge by Barr. So that is an assertion that Parnas is making. But I think it's really important for people as they're digesting this, you know, sort of tidal wave of new information on the eve of the Senate trial to look at what is documented contemporaneously in Lev Parnas' text messages or his notes versus what are his accusations and recollection. You know, when he made those statements on Rachel Maddow last night, I, as a reporter, wanted to know more about that. Yeah. What is your evidence for that? How do you know that? Who told you that? You know, those follow-up questions, which are the kind of questions that you would ask a witness under oath, weren't asked on the program. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about interpreting some of that.
She has part two tonight. But meanwhile, just in the few seconds we have, this Republican congressional candidate, Robert Hyde, Parnas had these documents showing that he was discussing the physical location of the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. We just heard they hated her. Some of these prosecutors hated her. Just in the few seconds we have, what are we to make of that?
You know, so Lev Parnas claims he doesn't actually believe that was happening. He essentially says this guy is nuts and sending me text messages and I didn't respond very much to him. So I think we still have a question about guy was essentially suggesting he had a private security team monitoring her in Ukraine. Did that actually happen?
Yeah.
That's the big question.
But why would he even care about her? This has just got to be unpeeled. Paul Soni, NASA security reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
That's Haitian American flautist, vocalist, and composer Natalie Joachet, whose first featured solo album, Femme d'Haïti, recorded with the Chicago-based ensemble Spectral Quartet, has earned her a Grammy nomination for Best World Music Album. Natalie's acclaimed album celebrates some of Haiti's most iconic yet unrecognized female artists and explores Natalie's Haitian heritage. And Natalie joins me now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's dig into this album, Femme d'Haïti, which literally translates to Women of Haiti in Creole. The genesis from this, I read, comes from a conversation you were having with your family about Haitian music and the role women played in it. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I was in Haiti back in December of 2015, and it was my first visit to Haiti after the passing of my maternal grandmother, who was a very important voice for me in my life. And it got me thinking about how prevalent the voices of women are in the landscape in Haiti, particularly in the countryside. But that when I looked at the popular music scene in Haiti, all I could really think of was, you know, very few women who had gained popularity. I think when people think of traditional Haitian music going back, you know, many years, they think of solo artists who are men, really, you know, group, big bands of men like Tabu Kombo. It's a very male-heavy group. And so I asked my parents, you know, who were female artists they could think of, who was on the radio when they were growing up. And they, too, could only really come up with a list of about a dozen or so women. And that was intriguing to me because, you know, in the scope of American history, if we had only a dozen or so women in the past 100 years who were famous, it would be very odd. So it piqued my interest also because, you know, if for there to have been so few, what was so special about them was really what I wanted to know. And I certainly found out in researching this project.
Yeah, and we want to explore a little bit more of the album and your Haitian identity and heritage. I want to go back, though, to talk a little bit about how you come to this point. How did you come to start playing the flute?
I started playing flute in elementary school, sort of by chance. I think a lot of people have this experience where, you know, someone comes to school and demonstrates all of the instruments and everybody sort of chooses one. So I truly just came home from school one day and I said, Mom, I think I'm going to play the flute. And there was not really a lot of rhyme or reason to it, but I'm glad that it's the instrument that I chose because I took to it really quickly. And I haven't wanted to stop playing since.
You also attended Juilliard as a young child. In fact, some joke that you were born in the school's lobby because you began attending programs there since you were 10. Tell us more about how that experience shaped you as a musician.
Absolutely. I am an alumnus of Juilliard's Music Advancement Program, which is actually a program that started in response to a lot of music programs being cut out of public school programs in New York and the tri-state area. And so I really started serious music study there when I was 10 years old. I'm also an alumnus of their pre-college division, which is, you know, their sort of premier pre-college program for exceptionally talented students. And I'm also a graduate of their college division. So I really grew up musically in that building.
a phenom you are. That's what it sounds like. I want to talk about the track La Misère Pie Douce. Let's take a listen to some of it. You say this is an old song that derives from Africa. Tell us a little about that history and the message behind it.
It is one that dates well back, but actually the version of it that I fell in love with is a rendition of Toto Bisense. And she was a beautiful Haitian female artist who was not only a singer, but also an actress and an avid storyteller. The translation of La Misère Pas Douce is misery is not sweet. And it speaks of being called to go to another place because you're not a person of the place that you exist in physically. And in many ways, this was a song that was used to encourage slaves to ready themselves for the Haitian Revolution. Mm. And, you know, not that different than the Negro spiritual, which often were, you know, simple songs with hidden messages. This song has a similar history. And I love this idea that it is possible to persevere out of extreme moments of hardship. And I think that that was relevant preceding the Haitian Revolution. It's just as relevant in Haiti and across the world today.
Yes, I want to talk to you a little bit about that. This week marks 10 years since Haiti experienced its worst natural disaster. That devastating 7-magnitude earthquake killed more than 300,000 people and left millions injured and homeless. And what's so beautiful about music, and your music in particular, is that you really reveal the soul and the beauty and the depth of being Haitian. There's so much that's happening right now. I know that you're probably thinking about that as you think about the beauty of your music and this album that is highly acclaimed and what's happening in Haiti right now.
I think, you know, I would have to agree with you that in many ways this album captures the spirit of Haitian people within music. It is one of strength. It is one of rebirth. It is one of perseverance. It's also quite a giving and joyous spirit. I go to Haiti quite often myself. I still have a lot of family there, and you still see the after effects of the 2010 earthquake. We've been through exceptionally trying times, and there are lots of historical reasons for that. There are political and social reasons for that as well. But you also see this beautiful sense of strength and perseverance in the people, that they will not be held down no matter what hardships come their way. And I'm proud myself to be standing as a Haitian American to give voice to the beauty that is not often shown about Haiti.
Hmm. In Femme d'Haïti, you mesh Haitian folk and popular traditions into contemporary classical music, and you also experiment with different genres and flutronics. That's the flautist pop duo that you're a part of. Let's take a listen to the track Crazy. Oh, I love that. I love that electronic sense there. Tell us more about flutronics and why you decided to integrate the flute, which is really typically thought of as a very traditional classical instrument, into more popular genres like electronic and hip hop.
A little bit over a decade now, I happened to be on the internet and I encountered the music of Allison Loggins Hull, who is now my partner in flutronics. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I myself had begun experimenting with electroacoustic music, also hip-hop, R&B, jazz, indie rock. And so when I stumbled upon Allison's music and found that she was doing the same thing, I thought to myself, you know, I must meet this person. And so I actually sent her a blind message on the internet and was just like, I think we should be friends. I love your music. And she agreed. And it turned out that we lived actually just blocks away from each other in Brooklyn, New York. And about a week later, we met up at her house and just talked to each other for hours. And both of us had this shared appreciation of the rigor and the sort of sheer excellence that comes from classical music training, but also the, you know, excitement and the beauty of other genres of music and why not be blending them together. And so that day, Flutronics was born. And I should mention that Allison, along with Tony Maimone, who is a creative collaborator of ours, the three of us co-produced Femme d'Haïti together. And so all of it is in this spirit of fusing together musical voices and personal voices, as is reflected on Femme d'Haïti with the conversations that we share through that project as well.
It's got to feel gratifying that you all have been nominated for Best World Music Album.
It's amazing. Every day, I think I still am like, did that really happen? It's a dream come true. And also just proud to be representing Haiti at the Grammys in this way. And this is my first solo record. And also for me, the first time that I'm sort of stepping into myself as an artist, really claiming all of my identities as being Haitian American, as being woman, as being a Black artist. When a project like this, which is so deeply personal, you have this sense of nervousness that you're going to put it out and maybe no one will care. Mm-hmm. Or and so I was so excited, and it feels really beautiful to have it received in this way.
Nathalie Choichet is a vocalist, flautist, and composer whose first featured solo album is up for a Grammy this year. Thank you for joining us, Nathalie, and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
$10.8 million. That's how much people in Illinois spent on marijuana during just the first 5 days of recreational pot sales. The demand caused some dispensaries to close or limit purchases because they were running out of the stuff. From member station WBEZ, Mariah Wolfel explains why, after months of preparation, the state couldn't deliver.
On a recent day, I drove to all 9 dispensaries in Chicago, and like many other people, I was just trying to find weed.
Is this the first time you've tried to buy legal?
I actually came by a couple days ago, and they had a sign out, so I'm a little annoyed.
This was the story nearly everywhere I went. Pot seekers met with signs that read, "Not serving recreational cannabis? Check back tomorrow." And that's led to massive wait times at the few shops that do have enough marijuana to go around, like Mission Dispensary on Chicago's South Side.
We still have 10 more minutes until open, and then these quantity limits are only to get us through the hump.
It's 9:45 in the morning, and Chris Curry is one of 50 folks in line taking directions from a customer service rep.
They got about 30 minutes out of me out here, but the line is moving, so.
What are you expecting when you go inside?
Just to be a marijuana buffet. I'm just here for the smoke.
Alas, a marijuana buffet, it is not. This dispensary is capping purchases at 4.5 grams per customer, enough for maybe 8 joints.
I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure there's much that they could have done to prevent shortages.
Chris Crane owns Chicago's Mission Dispensary and several others across the country.
These shortage issues have happened in basically every state, but it has been more pronounced in Illinois, and that was completely expected.
And that's what pretty much every single person in this industry will tell you, that this is not a surprise. Illinois approved recreational marijuana last June, and the state had until January 1st to transition from a medical marijuana market to a recreational one as well. The medical market here is pretty small compared to other states. There are about 85,000 cardholders currently, and that's double what it was just a year ago before the state expanded its list of eligible medical conditions. Another problem is that the plant takes time to grow.
With a living organism like this, it's not just like building a new machine and then turning on to get more capacity.
Jason Nelson is giving me a tour of Cresco Labs, one of Illinois' 21 grow houses, where it takes about 4 months to grow a plant.
We've got Apple Rock Candy. This one's kind of unique. This Rollins right here. Rollins is very.
He says to meet demand, growers had to start increasing production tenfold. They start cloning thousands of more plants per week, hiring hundreds of employees, expanding facilities. Nelson says all in 6 months.
we're literally doing it as quickly as humanly possible.
He says the seeds planted at that new facility should be fully grown and on the shelves in Illinois by March. But it could be longer for other grow centers. Nelson has one of the largest in the state market. Other people in the industry, like Chris Crane, the owner of Mission Dispensary, estimates it'll be 6 months to a year before Illinois gets close to meeting demand.
We're going to be dealing with these types of shortage issues, and we're going to be dealing with some lines. Because I think that while challenging, it was better than the alternative of delay implementation of the entire program, continuing to drive consumers to the illicit market.
Lawmakers say shortages are by design, meant to create demand for the folks who'll enter the market later this year, many of whom they hope will be Black entrepreneurs who've been impacted by the war on drugs. For consumers like Chris Curry, whose new dealer is now Mission Dispensary on the South Side, buying on the legal market is worth the wait.
You know what you're getting in here. You don't know what you're getting when you're on the street. So I just hope these lines die down soon.
For Here and Now, I'm Mariah Wolfel in Chicago.
An update now on a story we've been following. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a Trump administration executive order that allowed state and local governments to stop refugee resettlement. President Trump announced the order last September, requiring groups get written consent from state and local jurisdictions before they could help refugees resettle. Immigration advocates challenged the order in court, and on Wednesday, a judge in Maryland ruled the order is unconstitutional and does not appear to serve the overall public interest. The White House says the decision is preposterous and has not yet said if it will appeal. To California now, where Governor Gavin Newsom has been touring the state, laying out a $1.4 billion plan to combat the growing problem of homelessness. A quarter of the nation's homeless live in California, and in just 1 year, the number of people experiencing homelessness rose 16%. For more now, we're joined by Governor Newsom, who is in the midst of his California tour. Welcome, Governor.
Great to be with you.
Well, thanks for being here. So you've called the rate of homelessness in California an emergency, and you're treating it as such through an executive order. Let's get to the details of this plan. Among other things, you're proposing the use of public property around freeways to build camping trailers that would serve as short-term emergency shelters. And there's also a plan to boost the state's Medicaid programs for homeless people. It all sounds really ambitious. Give us a synopsis of how this will work and where you'll get the money from.
Well, you hit the highlights, a 16.4% increase in the number of people out in the streets and sidewalks. We have the nation's largest population of unsheltered homeless, over 108,000 individuals that we see out under the overpasses, on the street corners, all across the state. And I say all across. This is no longer just a coastal issue in big cities. This is now a dominant issue in rural California as well. And we need to treat it as the emergency it is. The state of California, respectfully, and I say this not to point fingers, but it's never been a point of emphasis and focus for state leaders over the course of the last few decades. That now has changed. The state is taking responsibility, and we are being ambitious, and we recognize we have to have a multi-pronged, comprehensive crisis response that includes a housing-first focus, but at the same time address the immediacy of the emergency at hand by providing these temporary solutions, these field shelters, these FEMA trailers that we are advancing in real time.
It's ambitious. It also costs a lot of money. Where would that money come from?
The general fund. It's a question of our values, our priorities. I will remind people the contrast in the state of California to the federal government. We're running record surpluses, record reserves, record low unemployment, record economic expansion. We are privileged to be in this position where we can make historic investments in not only stabilizing individuals, moving them off the streets, but substantively, fundamentally focusing on the solution to homelessness, which is housing and support services.
You've come under a lot of fire from President Donald Trump. He said that if California can't lower its homeless population, the federal government will get involved. And he's cited regulation in the housing market as a key driver for homelessness here in California. Your thoughts on the president's possible intervention in the state?
No thoughts, because it's as the form and substance, as so often is the case with his tweets of fog. We're focused on our responsibility. We are a nation state. We own this. We would love to see the federal administration in an enlightened frame support our efforts by providing the difference between the federal vouchers, housing vouchers, that are currently being underutilized in California for one reason, and that is they do not meet our housing costs, meaning the fair market rents in California are so high that these vouchers go unused. He can help support by providing resources to address that delta, and he would make a profound impact, and we would celebrate that. Beyond that, though, we are focusing on our own responsibility, working at every level of government, jurisdictional leaders across the state, to focus on these catalyst investments and to really focus on a coordinated, collaborative approach that is bipartisan, that doesn't look red or blue, rural or urban, all of us rowing in the same direction.
There are much more than tweets, though. I mean, the president actually had folks come on the ground in California and assess the situation. And so what I'm hearing from you is that if he would like to, and if the administration would like to get on board in helping to solve this problem, you'd be open to finding some sort of solution in that way.
Yeah, we've had direct correspondence to the president. I've sent him two letters with specific requests. No snarkiness attached to those requests. Open hand, not a closed fist. Say, Mr. President, we appreciate now your interest in this issue. It's been a point of emphasis for me as governor. The new count that just came out is from last year, the week, in fact, I took the oath of office. I own this, and Mr. President, we'd love to see you own this as well in partnership and collaboration. And so that's certainly the case, and we are hopeful that he'll thaw in terms of some of the edgier rhetoric, not play politics with this to embarrass Speaker Pelosi or embarrass city mayors or, for the that matter, the governor of California, but to really look at the humanity, the crisis that's behind this. We are better than this. We're capable of doing more. And we're going to provide our armories, our fairgrounds. We're going to provide these excess state properties. We're going to take these trailers that we purchased from FEMA. These mobile field shelters are what we call CalMat teams that have medical components to it. We're getting serious, but we're also providing unprecedented $1.4 plus billion dollars of additional new resources in this space as well.
Governor, over the past few weeks, the nation has been watching a group of moms in Oakland occupy a vacant home. They were evicted and removed just this week. And what they say is that they can't afford rent due to skyrocketing rents and what they call speculation. That's essentially investors treating housing as a commodity for the highest bidder. What are your thoughts on this? And is part of your plan clamping down or addressing what some feel is a predatory nature of speculators?
Yeah, no, look, I'm very proud. California just passed, and we worked very hard last year passing the most aggressive rent control protections in the United States of America, including just cause eviction protections, which I can assure you there's simply not a state in the country that's ever been more aggressive in this space. It just went into effect quite literally a few weeks ago. I also provided, with the legislature's support, and I'm proud of this, $331 million for legal aid and legal protections for renters as well. So we are hitting this head on. We're taking this very seriously. And this example in Oakland is emblematic of examples that are not generating headlines all across not only the state, but across this country. In California in particular, we have a disproportionate number of renters because of the density of our urban environments. We've got to protect our renters at peril of never addressing the issue of homelessness, because we never could catch up, because you've got to address the front end as you address the back end by providing more support.
So what I'm hearing from you, Governor, is you believe what you've been doing in the legislature can help offset what we're seeing in the market with these speculators who are coming in and really developing in a way that makes it unsustainable for those like these Oakland moms.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not just about an unscrupulous investor that's keeping units vacant. It's about the totality of a crisis that's been decades in the making of underdeveloping the state's resources as it relates to its housing stock. We are developing less than 100,000 housing units on an annual basis. We need to be developing north of 300,000+ housing units. As a consequence, it's simple Econ 101, supply, demand. At the same time, you also have to focus on prevention and preservation, preserving your existing housing stock, preventing people from being displaced in the first place. But production is that third P, and that is also part of the totality of our toolkit as we approach this. And for what it's worth, my budget last year included $1.75 billion for new tax credits, revolving loan funds, infill grant support to help stimulate housing production in the state. And you may have noted some high-profile lawsuit that I filed against Huntington Beach for simply not even planning to produce units in the state of California. We're starting now to hold jurisdictions accountable to actually producing results, not rhetoric, in this space as well.
Your proposed plan and budget needs to be approved by lawmakers by June 15th. You're on the ground this week visiting communities across the state. There will be much more to follow here. Thank you so much, Governor Newsom, for your time.
Grateful to be with you. Thank you.
And that's California Governor Gavin Newsom.
An update now on the Elizabeth Warren-Bernie Sanders dust-up in Tuesday's presidential debate. Sanders saying he never told Warren that a woman couldn't win in 2020. She implying he had. Well, CNN has now released audio of the moment after, when she appeared to refuse to shake his hand.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion? We'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it.
Well, so both felt misrepresented, but Warren was never asked during the debates whether Sanders told her in those words a woman couldn't win. He's previously said they can. She instead made the point that they have, that she and Amy Klobuchar were the only candidates on the stage who've never lost. Well, you can be sure this will come up again. And from politics here in the U.S. to what's going on in Russia, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and his entire cabinet quitting yesterday after President Putin outlined constitutional reforms that could keep him in power well past 2024 when his term expires. And today, the Russian parliament approved Putin's new choice for prime minister, Mikhail Mishustin, who's been head of the tax service. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. And Sarah, one Russia paper is calling this the January Revolution. But be clear, did Medvedev and his cabinet quit because they were disgusted at Putin's power grab? Or because, you know, he's moved the chess pieces before. He installed Medvedev. Did they quit because Putin told them to?
Yes, this was not a protest departure. This was very much a part of the bigger picture, the bigger plan. This Russia that we know under Vladimir Putin doesn't have surprise departures and resignations. Mm. So, yes, this was an organized thing. But it was still a surprise to the wider public. Definitely nobody was expecting the government to suddenly en masse resign. That wasn't seen coming. So it was a surprising day, an extraordinary day, really, I should say, in modern Russian politics, the kind of thing that we haven't really seen, we don't really remember for over a decade.
Well, and what are people there saying? Because we're reading, you know, people who are longtime Putin critics saying that this is a return to Soviet-style politics. What's the sense there?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that the change of government, the change of prime minister is much is about much more than just changing the government. I think first and foremost, it is about that. It's about President Putin wanting to send a signal that he understands that there's a lot of economic problems in the country that need to be addressed. And by naming a new prime minister, he's hoping to send the signal that he is going to do that, that this government can do what previous ones haven't. I think bigger than that, though, more broadly than that, this is about his own future. He's proposing constitutional reform, measures that will change the balance of power here in some ways that could, in theory, in the future, allow him to maintain influence in Russia after he steps down as president. He's got to go in 2024, but it looks like he's sort of paving the way for where he goes next in order to retain authority here, because he's got a lot to protect.
Well, he's done this before. I mean, I said he installed Medvedev. He did this once before, and he made Medvedev the president and himself prime minister, you know, just so he could kind of rotate the roles and hold on to power. But how is that reform?
Yes, he did do that before. He can't do the same thing again because of the Constitution. It prohibits that. But what he's doing is portraying these reforms as more democracy. He's talking about basically taking the power structures, the power generally in this country, closer to the people. So what he's saying is, whilst the presidency will be the most strong institution still, because Russia is a big, diverse country which needs a strong ruler, he's saying that some powers are being transferred to the parliament, which is representative of the people more directly, and that's more democratic. He's also increasing the powers of another body here, which represents all the governors in the country, the State Council. And actually, it sounds a bit boring, but I think that's key. This is the organ of power which Mr. Putin already heads up. It's been pretty pretty inactive, I guess, in the past. But if it has more power, which we think is going to happen, then potentially that's the vehicle that Mr. Putin might use to pull the strings in the future.
Yeah. And tell us more about Mikhail Mishustin. Again, today Russia's parliament approved Putin's new choice for prime minister, this head of Russia's tax service. He's played a lot of hockey with Putin, and everyone knows that Putin scores the goals when you play hockey. So he's obviously already understood that. And here he is now prime minister. So you could say maybe just a toady. But he's also somebody who's been applauded for truly modernizing Russia's tax administration. So what is the thinking about him?
I think one interesting question is, you know, a lot of people were thinking the person who eventually replaces Mr. Medvedev as prime minister would, in theory, be the next president in waiting. Now, it's a big question whether we could suggest that we should be watching Mikhail Mishustin to see if he is the next president. Or maybe, as I say, he's simply in there to show that President Putin wants to address the big problems, economic problems in particular, that Russia still has.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford speaking with us from Moscow. A headline you may have missed, given all the ones coming from here in the U.S., that just about the entire government there resigned and is being shaken up. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Robert Fletcher survived 3 years as a prisoner of war in Korea. He was buried at Arlington National Cemetery, but not with the recognition his daughter felt he deserved.
It was just so humiliating for me to learn that my dad could not receive full honors.
So she worked to change the rules. Next time, Here and Now.